Hello, folks. Welcome to First Thursday, the monthly podcast from the Labor Relations Information System. My name is Will Aitchison. I'll be your host for the next 45 minutes or so as we go through recent developments in the public safety workplace. But first, I want to start with a little bit of a war story. It's not often that I end up getting involved with the press on a story that they are developing. But it has been happening this year, or last year, excuse me. Already made my first 2020 mistake there. It's been happening in 2020 with a frequency that I have experienced at no time in my career. I am getting called all the time from news outlets around the country asking for a comment or background information on this and that, always dealing with policing and the protests around policing. Well, so it was that in September of this year, I started getting phone calls from some New York Times reporters who were doing an article on binding arbitration of disciplinary cases for police. There were three articles. I spoke to them at least three times for a number of hours, actually, in total that I spoke to them. And I viewed it as an opportunity. An opportunity to make a central point about the issue of binding arbitration of police. And the point was this. We see reported in the popular press the notion that police unions are inordinately powerful because they overturn at least half of all discipline in binding arbitration. And my point, the one that I wanted to make to the New York Times reporters, was that statistic is fundamentally misleading because police unions do not challenge every disciplinary decision in arbitration. In my career, a career that stretches back decades, my experience has been that police unions challenge discipline less than 5% of the time. Yes, once they get to arbitration, they do win half of those cases, like truck drivers win half of their cases, and firefighters do, and nurses and teachers. Yes, they do win half of their cases. But what it means when police are only appealing less than 5% of their cases, it means that the employer's disciplinary decision stands untouched by arbitration well over 95% of the time. In fact, if I take a look at my track record with the one that I have with clients that I've represented over the years, that number is perilously close to 99%. So I took the opportunity in these interviews with the reporters to make that point. I made it four times. And the point that I made to them was the issue here isn't arbitration of police discipline. If you're looking for problems with the police disciplinary system, you need to look elsewhere because arbitrators have an impact on less than 5% of police disciplinary decisions. I made that point on four separate occasions. And then in December, when I looked at the front page of the New York Times that had the story a lengthy story. Do you think they published that? Of course not, right? It detracted from the dominant narrative. So I immediately wrote a letter to the editor. And the letter to the editor said the article was based on an incorrect premise. And the incorrect premise was that arbitrators consider all police disciplinary cases. They don't. They consider very, very, very few of them. Do you think they published that letter to the editor? Now, mind you, I was somebody they thought important enough to make a phone call to and to interview for hours. And they did not publish the central point that I was making. Now, you know, I'm a grown boy, right? I realize that all media outlets have their biases. They have the narratives, the stories that they want to tell. But I'll tell you, I was fundamentally disappointed with the fact that a newspaper that is, I think, our best newspaper in the country would behave in such a fashion. I promptly got in touch with a reporter and said, or the lead reporter, and said, how could you do this? He said, there'll be a follow-up story and you can make your point then. Yep, I think I'm going to hold my breath on that, right? Not. Another prefatory note that I wanted to share with you, and this too is a law enforcement issue. There's a big study that came out from, it's published on the National Bureau of Economics Review website, and we will post it with this podcast. It's an article that deals with the statistical relationship between the size of a police force and various police actions and interactions, particularly with people of different races. It's a long article. It's 72 pages long. Fair warning, it's written by three social scientists, one of whom is an economics professor, which means it's dense and it's very, very difficult, at least for me, to understand. But I'll tell you what you can draw from this. If you are in any sort of discussion in your cities or counties about reducing the size of your law enforcement agency, you need to get to this paper. Here are the broad conclusions of this paper. Number one, if you add police officers, you get a very substantial reduction in the homicide rate. And that is particularly true. You get double the effect in Hispanic communities. And it is really, really true in African-American communities where you get four times the effect that you get for the general population. Conclusion number two. You increase the number of police officers, you have more arrests for indexed crimes. Indexed crimes, think of them as the serious crimes, felonies in most states. And that stands to reason as well, right? More police officers, they're out in the community more, there's more of an ability to arrest people for crimes. Number three, more police officers translates to more what are called quality of life arrests. So arrests for things like loitering or public drunkenness and the like. Most of the major police departments I know of don't have time to arrest anybody for those things, but the study goes back many years, goes back decades, and it shows a strong relationship between additional police and these quality of life arrests. And you can debate whether that's a good thing or a bad thing. I don't think you can debate the first two, the murder rate and the index crime rate. You can debate whether the quality of life arrests going up or going down are in general good for us. But you can't debate that the effect is there. It happens. Fourth, there is an almost non-existent but slight increase in the use of deadly force by police with more police officers. And the authors of the report don't say why, but it stands to reason, right? You're putting officers into communities where there are higher crime rates, the higher arrests for index crimes, you're going to end up with more deadly force incidents. It seems pretty natural. It is not a big effect. It is almost a statistically insignificant effect. And the last conclusion, there's more conclusions in the article. I'm just giving you the highlights that I drew out of it. The last conclusion was that with more police officers, you have measurably, this is a much stronger statistical effect, measurably lower officer injuries that are the result of attacks from suspects. So interesting study. Take a look at it. If you're like me, you may need someone to translate some of the charts and tables that are in it. And I can only go so many times to one of my sons and say, so what is a T value again? So you may need to find someone who can explain that sort of stuff to you.
All right, our first case this month comes to us courtesy of the Washington Court of Appeals, and it raises an issue that I'll bet a lot of you are going to see in 2021 or 2022. What happens if the parties to bargaining can't agree on whether or not bargaining should be open to the public? This case comes to us courtesy of Lincoln County, which is a smallish county in the state of Washington. Teamsters Local 690 represents a couple of bargaining units of Lincoln County employees. And in 2016, the County Board of Commissioners passes a resolution. This resolution, which was passed without any notice at all to the Teamsters, required that all collective bargaining be done in public. Why? The county was getting pressure from an outfit known as the Freedom Foundation, which is one of these Koch brothers-supported conservative think tanks, about opening bargaining to the public. And the county thought, this was the thinking of the Board of Commissioners, if we open up bargaining to the public and we need a tax increase, the voters will be more likely to approve a tax increase if we can tell them that we bargained in the public. Well, Local 690 hears about this and immediately asks the county to rescind its recent resolution. The county refuses, and then the two sit down and in January of 2017 have a very strange bargaining session. The bargaining session is attended by a reporter, so it's open to the public, or at least it starts that way. Local 690 announces that it disagrees with holding the meetings in public and was not waiving its position, but that it was willing to talk for a while. And the parties actually come to tentative agreements on several issues, but then because of the presence of the reporter, they decide they're not going to talk about others. And when they got to those harder issues, the sheriff, so a member of the employer's bargaining team, asked whether or not Local 690 and the county could discuss those harder issues in private bargaining. And in fact, they went off and they discussed those issues privately. So in February 2017, a month later, Local 690 passes its own resolution. Didn't know unions passed resolutions, but Local 690 did. And this resolution, which was passed without notice to the county, required all bargaining to be done in private. And then the parties show up for their next bargaining session. The county says, we want to bargain in public. Local 690 says, we want to bargain in private. The county says, unless we bargain in public, we're not bargaining. Local 690 says, unless we bargain in private, we're not bargaining. And the meeting ends. And both sides go off and file unfair labor practice complaints with Washington's Public Employment Relations Commission, alleging that the other is failing to bargain in good faith. So Washington's PERC has to kind of unravel this mess. And the first thing it does, PERC says, both of you committed unfair labor practices because the procedures used for bargaining, you know, the sorts of procedures that are normally captured by ground rules, the procedures used for bargaining are not themselves mandatory topics for bargaining. Neither of you can insist on a non-mandatory subject of bargaining over the objection of the other. And we have ruled, PERC says, for years and years and years. And by the way, so have labor boards and commissions in every state that I've seen. We have ruled that ground rules and bargaining procedures are not mandatory for bargaining. So what does PERC do about this situation? What's the remedy? PERC tells the parties, you need to go back and you need to negotiate in good faith over whether you're going to have public bargaining. If you can't agree after two sessions, PERC will send a mediator to assist you. And if mediation fails, PERC says, then you've got to go back to the status quo in the last bargaining, which was private bargaining. Both sides appealed to the Washington Court of Appeals. And the Washington Court of Appeals largely upholds PERC's decision. I say largely because it doesn't uphold the remedy decision. So first of all, on the merits, did the parties commit unfair labor practice complaints or unfair labor practices? And PERC says, yeah, they did. You know, the law's been around forever. The ground rules and bargaining procedures are not mandatory for bargaining. County raises the objection that the way we do bargaining is, and I'm quoting, at the core of entrepreneurial control. That is a management right. The Washington Court of Appeals says, we don't actually agree with that. We don't think it's either a managerial prerogative or a union prerogative. It's simply a procedure. So therefore, you've both committed unfair labor practices. But what about the remedy? The Court of Appeals says, here's where PERC made a mistake. And I think the court may have gotten this one right. Normally, if you see a dispute between a labor board and a court on how to interpret labor laws, usually the labor board's going to be right, but I actually think the court got this right. The court says you can't send them back to the status quo, meaning private bargaining. You can't send them back to the status quo as a remedy here because the status quo doctrine doesn't apply to non-mandatory subjects of bargaining. It only applies to wages, hours, and working conditions. And we've just told you that ground rules, bargaining procedures, are not mandatory for bargaining. So we're going to send this case back to PERC to reconsider what the appropriate remedy is. Does the court give any suggestion as to what it thinks the appropriate remedy might be? It does, but what the court suggests makes no sense at all. If you look at this opinion, and of course we'll post the opinion on our website, if you look at the opinion, look for footnote 5, and you'll see the court says, you know, what PERC might do is send the parties to arbitration over whether you're going to have public bargaining. And the reason I think that doesn't make any sense is you can't force arbitration over a non-mandatory subject of bargaining, at least not in the context of negotiating a new contract. I think PERC is going to have a huge challenge here when it gets this case back as to the remedy that it ends up awarding. It's very, very difficult because at the heart of everything here is a non-mandatory subject of bargaining, a ground rule, a bargaining procedure. And I can't imagine if PERC can't restore the status quo, I actually can't think of what PERC can do. I welcome everybody's suggestions, and I'll pass them on to the litigants in this case on both sides. I welcome anybody's idea as to what the remedy possibly could be in this case. Now, the solution, of course, is if you want public bargaining, you don't try to get it through the bargaining process. You go to the legislature, and you have the legislature specify, usually in its public records law, that or public meetings law, that bargaining sessions are open to the public. Washington doesn't have that sort of law. You can see the court basically, and there's a concurring opinion that I think is pretty thoughtful in this case. You can see the majority and concurring opinions kind of pointing everybody towards the legislature to fix whatever this is. We're going to head across the country to West Virginia for our next case. It's a firefighter case, and it's not particularly revolutionary, but I think it reminds all of us that if you don't like the result in the case I'm about to describe, the solution, as with the whole question of public bargaining, is to go to the legislature to change what the underlying statute says. This is a workers' compensation case. It involves a firefighter for the Huntington Fire Department in West Virginia, a guy by the name of John Angle. Angle files a workers' compensation claim for post-traumatic stress disorder and something that is referred to as compassion exhaustion disorder. So basically, it's a PTSD claim. And what Angle says is, look, I have witnessed all number of deaths and disturbing incidents in my career as a firefighter. And it's gotten much worse. It has gotten much worse because of the opioid epidemic. I go out on about 4,000 calls a year, and I have seen all sorts of trauma. People dying, people who have passed away, people who are severely injured. And now I have a very concrete set of symptoms that have been diagnosed as PTSD. And those symptoms include difficulty sleeping, nightmares, irritability, mood swings, lack of compassion, you know, many of the symptoms that I think we're all familiar with of PTSD. The city denies the workers' compensation claim. Why? The city points to a provision in the West Virginia Code. And this is a provision of the code called Section 23-4. And here's what it says. No alleged injury or disease shall be recognized as a compensable injury or disease which was solely caused by non-physical means and which did not result in any physical injury or disease to the person claiming benefits. And if that wasn't clear enough, the statute goes on to say, it is the purpose of this section to clarify that so-called mental claims are not compensable under this chapter. And the West Virginia Supreme Court upholds the denial of Angle's workers' compensation claim. Here's what the court says. I'm going to quote a couple sentences from its opinion. Angle alleges that he developed PTSD as a result of years of work as a firefighter. However, Angle also denied that any particular injury caused his post-traumatic stress disorder. All of Angle's symptoms and the requested or the associated diagnoses were caused by non-physical means and did not result in any physical injury or disease. The court says, bottom line, under this code section 23-4, the claim was properly denied. Now, workers' compensation laws vary tremendously from state to state. In some states, there is no requirement for a physical injury. In other states, there is a requirement for physical injury. In some states, PTSD is specifically called out as a compensable condition, at least for public safety employees, police and fire. As I mentioned at the outset of talking about this case, the reason I bring it up is you need to check your state law, see what the requirements are for not just PTSD, but also it could be chronic depression that is brought on by the job, whatever it might be. See what the requirements are under your workers' compensation laws. It may be time to update those laws. Next up, I'd like to talk about a Pennsylvania police officer who had an unusual set of working conditions for a while. And I want to talk about not just his case, but whether or not some other claims could have been brought in his case. So what's this all about? I'm not going to tease you any longer about it. This is Officer Michael Fioca of the Philadelphia Police Department. He worked in the Forensic Science Unit. And starting in 2015 or 2016, Fioca and the other officers in the unit got access to the daily attendance record sheets of all officers in the unit. So any one of the officers could see the attendance records of any of the other officers in the unit. Fioka was interested in the vacation and sick leave balances of other officers, as well as the amount of overtime worked for every other officer, worked by every other officer in the unit. And when Fioka looks at those overtime records in particular, he gets a little bit angry. He thinks he's wrongfully been denied overtime. So he files a lawsuit against the city, in a lawsuit in state court, alleging that he had been unlawfully denied overtime. The case is quickly settled. Let's call that the prior lawsuit by Fioka. Yeah, there'll be another one. In 2017, Fioka and his lieutenant, a fellow by the name of Jonah Conway, Fioka and Conway have a conversation. And Conway is interested in the prior lawsuit. Fioka says, can't talk to you about that because under the terms of the settlement, everything that happened is confidential. And then in very short order after that meeting, Fioka realized that he no longer had access to the daily attendance record sheets. Fioka complains to Conway, says, what happened? How come I can't get these records anymore? Conway tells Fioka that he terminated Fioka's access to the record sheets. And Conway says, look, if you want access, you need to write a letter to IT downtown in order to get access. Fioka speaks with IT, and IT tells him, you know what? It wasn't just you. Conway terminated the access to these attendance records to everybody who is assigned to the unit. And Conway later admits, yep, that's exactly what I did. I didn't think that non-supervisory employees should have records, access to the attendance records belonging to other employees. And he says, I terminated that access because I was concerned about the interests of privacy. Well, Fioka notices that his coworkers aren't talking to him anymore. And he gets upset about that. So he sends Conway a series of messages that contain remarks that I think you can fairly call insubordination. Fioka sends a message to another supervisor complaining about his loss of access to these records. This message contains the statement, quote, you can talk to Conway Dickhead. Yep, that's what I called him. And tell him that he ratted on me like a little effing pussy that he is. You can see Fioka's a little bit upset about this whole situation. Fioka also told the supervisor, meet me one-on-one, and I will straighten your effing ass out. Well, a police inspector learns that this has happened and tells Fioka, you're being transferred. You're being sent over to the Delaware Valley Intelligence Center, and we're going to take your gun away. And for 2 months, Fioka worked at the center, this intelligence center, without his service weapon. And while he's at the center, he was never given even one assignment. He would show up for graveyard shift, and his place of his reporting site was a warehouse. The lights would go off, and Fioka would sit in a corner all by himself for 8 hours. During his shifts at the center, Fioka was not allowed to use his phone. He later testifies he, quote, couldn't even go to the bathroom because I couldn't see where the bathroom was. There were no lights on. So Fioka brings a federal court lawsuit against the city, alleging that the city retaliated against him in violation of his First Amendment rights. What First Amendment issue? Where's his speech? Actually filing a lawsuit is considered to be speech protected by the First Amendment. So the fact that he filed that first lawsuit, what I referred to as the prior lawsuit, that's speech that's potentially protected by the First Amendment, or is protected by the First Amendment. And Fiocca's case eventually gets heard by a federal court judge. And the judge said, well, it's not enough, Fiocca, that you're able to prove that you engaged in protected speech. You also have to prove a causal relationship between the speech and the act of retaliation. Clearly, says the court, assigning you to work in a corner in a dark room. That looks like the stuff of which a retaliation claim is made. But you got to link up the two pieces of the puzzle here. You've got to link up your filing the prior lawsuit and resolving it through the settlement and the act of retaliation. So how do you prove a causal connection in a case like this, that the first event caused the second? And in almost all of these cases, the proof is by implication. You very rarely find an employer that comes in and says, yeah, we did this because he exercised his First Amendment right. Instead, you're proving it by circumstantial evidence. And what Fiocca tries to do is to say there is temporal proximity between the prior lawsuit and the act of retaliation here. And you can infer discrimination if two events are very close in time to each other. The federal court says, well, you're right and you're wrong, Fiocca. You're right. Temporal proximity can be the basis to infer a causal connection, but you weren't close enough in time here. And I'm quoting, almost 3 months passed between Fiocca's refusal to discuss the prior lawsuit and the city's first alleged adverse employment action. An intervening temporal period of 3 months between a protected activity and an adverse employment action is not unusually suggestive of retaliatory motive and is insufficient to establish the requisite causal connection. What would be close enough in time? The court cites other opinions where the distance in time between the protected activity and the act of retaliation was a matter of days, not weeks, not months. Courts really don't like these temporal proximity arguments all that much. They usually will fail. You see that happen. Now, I told you there was another way potentially to address this issue. And that would have been through the bargaining process, right? Would the assignment of Fiocca to a corner of a dark warehouse on the graveyard shift, would that be a change in status quo about a mandatory subject of bargaining? Well, let's assume, first of all, that it's a change in status quo, that the Philadelphia Police Department doesn't have a past practice of assigning officers to dark corners of dark warehouses. But would that assignment be a mandatory subject to bargaining that the city would not be allowed to make without discharging its bargaining obligation? In most states, yes. In most states, an assignment of this sort under these very, very unusual working conditions would have been mandatory for bargaining. And there's no indication in this opinion whether or not Fiocca's union insisted on bargaining and whether anything happened in that regard. But that would have been another way to have handled this issue. You see these issues come up from time to time in the fire service more than you do with police. You see firefighters who, at least they're claiming in an act of retaliation, are forced to cut the lawn or are on put on latrine duty for months at a time. But you don't see these sorts of cases, go sit in a dark warehouse. You don't see them on the police side very often. So there's not a lot of law in the area. But at any rate, the case is a good reminder that The whole notion of temporal proximity between protected activity and an act of alleged retaliation, that has to be very, very close in time. The last case I want to talk about today involves a kind of a technical question. When is it that federal claims have to be arbitrated under a grievance procedure in a collective bargaining agreement? And we've got this kind of fascinating case that comes out of Pekin, I hope I'm pronouncing that correctly, Illinois, the police department in Pekin, Illinois. John Brooks, Gregory Simmons are two police officers in Pekin. Brooks and Simmons sue the city, and they sue a number of department employees in federal court. And they say, look, our troubles, our woes began when Simmons, one of the two plaintiffs, made an internal harassment complaint against his shift commander, a fellow named Gregory Burris. That prompted a fourth individual, a police officer by the name of Jennifer Melton, to make a false accusation against Simmons, the person who made the complaint against the lieutenant. Brooks was ordered to investigate Melton's complaints against Simmons. Brooks thought that Melton's claims were not true, and things kind of spun out of control, and eventually the city terminates both Brooks and Simmons, and they bring the lawsuit. I know that's a little bit complicated, but that's a factual situation that unwound. The lawsuit that Brooks and Simmons filed had a number of claims. I only want to talk about one of them, but it had a whole bunch of them, including a claim that Brooks had a disability that was protected by the Americans with Disabilities Act, and the city failed to reasonably accommodate his disability. There were retaliation claims. There were claims that they were the victims of age discrimination, a garden variety Title VII claim, and miscellaneous other statutory and constitutional claims. The two of them clearly opened the book on how can I sue thee, let me count the ways, in terms of the number of claims that they brought. And before the litigation goes too far, the city files what's known as a motion to stay. And a motion to stay means let's hold these federal court proceedings in abeyance pending a grievance, the resolution of a grievance that was filed by one of the two plaintiffs, filed by Simmons. Simmons, it turns out, had filed a grievance under his collective bargaining agreement, claiming that he was terminated without just cause. And that grievance was headed to, or actually was at, arbitration. And the city, in filing the motion for a stay, says, look, under the Federal Arbitration Act, the FAA, as it's called, the litigation has to be stayed so that arbitration can do its thing. And a federal court judge rejects the city's argument. And what the court ends up finding is that while the FAA, the Federal Arbitration Act, does cover some employment agreements, the employment agreements have to involve the same claims that are being litigated in federal court. So that panoply of different claims that Simmons and Brooks had here, they had to be the topic of Simmons' grievance. And the court says this is where the city's argument fails. The court holds that, and I'm quoting, it is understandable why the defendants, the city, focus more on Simmons' termination as a reason to stay the proceedings against him. But in fact, the termination is the only fact in common between the arbitration proceedings and his federal lawsuit. The court says, the arbitration proceeding is on a contract clause that requires just cause for discipline. Nothing in the collective bargaining agreement requires the arbitration of all these other claims. The ADA claim, the Title VII claim, the Age Discrimination and Employment Act claim. And in order for the Federal Arbitration Act to kick in and require me, the court says, the judge says, to stay these proceedings, those claims would have to be the subject of the arbitration. Hence, the arbitration can go forward and these court proceedings will go forward. There is no, and here's the test that the court uses, there is no clear and unmistakable waiver in the collective bargaining agreement of Simmons' rights to a judicial forum for his federal claims of employment discrimination. No waiver, no stay. So with that, thank you for joining us for the first 2021 First Thursday podcast. We've had the opportunity to record. I'm sure I speak for everybody in saying 2021 has to be better than 2020, right? We're getting very encouraged at LRIS by the fact that we are getting a number of seminar registrations. We are starting our seminars up again in May in Las Vegas. It looks like we're going to be back at full strength, hopefully in a couple of months, with our staff all recalled from their very, very part-time status. It's been very difficult to run a seminar business when you can't actually hold seminars, and we're encouraged by the words of support that many of you have sent in. So with that, I look forward to next month's First Thursday. We'll have a new round of cases. This is Will Aitchison signing off.